Welcome to Trust Radio, the Investment Trust podcast brought to you by Janus Henderson Investors. I'm Laura Thomas, and in this episode, I'm joined by Mike Curley, fund manager of Henderson Far East Income Limited. We explore the theme of value investing, Mike's approach to stock selection, and reflections on 2020. We also discuss which areas are seeing the most growth in the Asia-Pacific region as we think about asset allocation in the months ahead. But before we get into that, I must tell you that this episode is brought to you in association with Janus Henderson Investors. It's for promotional purposes, and the value of an investment can fall as well as rise. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and nothing in this podcast should be construed as advice. Anything said in this episode is the view of the fund manager when we recorded and may have changed as events have developed over time. Our discussion is for illustrative purposes only, and references made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase a security. Hi, Mike, and welcome to the show. So we're here today to explore the theme of value investing. And I wanted to kick off with a suggestion by Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's longtime business partner at Berkshire Hathaway, that all good investing is value investing. Is this a statement you'd agree with?
Yes, I would. But value means different things to different people. So whether you're a growth manager or an income manager or a value manager, I think it's important that you place a value on any of those styles. So if you're a growth manager, you want to price today what you think future growth will be. Whereas an income manager and a value manager will look to find, you know, companies that are trading at a discount to their future prospects, whether that's through cash flow generation or income generation. And it's important to know, I think, that overpaying for growth or overpaying for income puts capital at risk, in my opinion. So without some kind of value discipline, to be honest, I think it's very difficult to invest without that.
Sure. So I guess that leads me on quite nicely to my next question, which is around Henderson Far East Income's a value-driven approach. And I think you've kind of touched on this in your previous answer. So for you and for the trust in that respect, you know, how do you define the value? And therefore, what are the key criteria on which you're basing stock selection?
Well, value for us is based on cash flow generation, i.e. the current price of future cash flows, because ultimately a cash flow is what pays dividends going forward. So we price the value of those future cash flows, discount them back to where we are today, and make sure that we're not overpaying for that cash flow and that yield going forward. And it's very important to us, and this is something we stick to religiously, is, as I said earlier in the previous answer, that, you know, overpaying for that cash flow generation in the future is not only risky, because then you're making forecasts potentially of things you can't predict, or making heroic forecasts in order to justify a price. So for us, it's being very conservative about where we think cash flow generation will be in the years ahead, what levels of growth, et cetera, and what that will mean for us in terms of the value of the company as of now. It's also quite important as well for us is to find a catalyst for value, because we also hear stories of value traps, companies that are perennially cheap, which is fine, but obviously there's no capital appreciation in that. So for us, part of what we look for in the portfolio is excess levels of cash flow, which will generate higher dividends. So for us, higher dividends over time is a catalyst to realize that value.
Sure. So this much more nuanced approach, driven probably by the income aspect of the trust, is certainly kind of a differentiating factor between seeking out value between, say, the Henderson Far East Income and more growth-focused funds.
Yes, that's fair. I mean, you know, we like growth. We are income managers, so clearly dividends matter to us. And we split the portfolio between companies which have high and sustainable yields, and then companies which have dividend growth. And it's these dividend growth companies where we look for that catalyst of dividend surprise generated from excess cash flow, which also helps our dividend growth in the portfolio, but also helps the capital appreciation through the realization of these value names.
Great, thank you. And I noticed that the trust has no formal benchmark index.
Could you talk to us a bit more about exactly why that is and therefore how you measure its relative performance?
Yeah, I think part of that's historic. The benchmarks in the past, I mean, the company's been going since 1989. So the benchmarks in the past generally don't do what we do in terms of the way we look at companies and the way we look at yield. Now, as time has progressed, there are high yield equivalents now. But even so, it still doesn't do what we do. So when myself and the board look at the performance of the company, we look at the combination of the high yield index and the broad index, but just as a guide to measure where we are. And we expect certain characteristics in the portfolio relative to those two indices. And we also use that as a measure of risk as well. We expect certain characteristics. And if we don't have those characteristics relative to those two indices, then we want to know why. So the board measures the performance based roughly around those two indices, but also on peer group performance.
And I just wanted to turn really to last year, to 2020. You know, a few asset managers and fund managers will have experienced a year as challenging as that. But in the context of value investing, had been predominantly out of favor, you know, well before the emergence of the coronavirus. Indeed, there's probably some that will say that, you know, it might have been for the best part of the last decade. So I'd just be keen to get your thoughts really as to what you feel the key factors are that have been driving that protracted underperformance.
I think the last 20 years have been incredibly strange from an investment standpoint. Now, I've been fortunate the right word, I'm not sure, to be in investing for that long and even longer. But really from 2000, when we post the tech boom and bust, and leading up to the GFC in 2007, that was a period of time where we saw enhanced globalization, some moves in technology, et cetera, et cetera. And then post the GFC, we've had this period of dominated by quantitative easing, ultra low interest rates, and also quite a big step change in technology. And I think that's kind of some distorted some of the usual parameters for growth and value investing, especially ultra low interest rates. I think when you have interest rates where we do currently in the 1 or 2% range, and we go back again to that question about value and how you value growth, it makes it a lot easier to justify some of these high growth companies when interest rates are as low as they are. To be honest, some of that's been extrapolated to the nth degree where we are now, to the point maybe it's got excessive. Whereas value has struggled generally because we haven't had a normal investment cycle. Value tends to do better when you have a normal interest rate cycle, which, let's face it, we haven't had for 10 years. We haven't had huge periods of economic growth either, which again usually is quite supportive of value compared to growth. So I think, you know, the last 20 years has been very strange for looking at the relationships between those two styles. I'd like to think at some point we go back to what I would consider to be normal investing environment. But from where we are at this point, it seems that that's not going to be anytime soon. I think the positive things really for value is that we are at this point in time in a economic upcycle, and there is some inflationary pressure because of all the government support and central bank support. So these are rich hunting grounds for the value investor when you have rising interest rate potential, rising inflation and economic recovery. That should support value versus growth in the short term. But for us to return to a normal investment cycle, we need a normal interest rate period, which is more difficult to predict.
Yes, no, of course. And I just wanted to pick up on that point you mentioned there about sort of the opportunities for a value investor at the moment. I think it's, you know, we've just been talking about how it's been so it's kind of out of favor in comparison to growth, but it has rarely been cheaper. And on the contrast, the premium applied to growth has almost never been higher. You know, globally, the value to growth PE gap is the largest we've seen, as you said, for about 20 years. And, you know, there's evidence that supports the view that a wide dispersion in pricing between the value and growth stocks often or can, in circumstances, precede a value cycle. So I'd be keen to get your thoughts really on the value horizon and indeed sort of the impact that may have for the trust as well. You know, do you think there'll be a key trigger which will kind of drive the necessary re-rating?
Well, I think it comes down to valuation differentials and growth differentials, which is what you alluded to there. So, you know, when we look at absolute levels of valuation of indices across the world, they're all at highs or pretty close to highs. And a lot of that is based on the fact that we're going to see a very strong period of earnings growth as we come out of lockdown and the COVID impact dissipates. But the value differential is key here. So to give you an example, the way the MSCI All Country Asia Pacific Japan Index valuation at this point in time is at record highs, very high. And the growth part of that index is at over 40 times earnings. And that's expected to have 30% earnings growth. The broad index is on 20 times earnings, again at highs. The value index is only at 16 times. But the growth expectations for the value index are at 20% earnings growth. So if you've got half the level of valuation of the value index compared to the growth index, but only a 30% difference in growth expectations. So to my mind, you know, growth is a sector which tends to do well when growth is scarce. As we've seen through the last 3 or 4 years with some of these structural themes playing out. People have been more prepared to buy the structural themes and the expectation that's where the growth is. Whereas economic growth has been fairly benign, so there's been little cyclical uplift for the value sector. But at this point in time, earnings growth expectations are pretty similar and valuations are incredibly wide. So to me, the gap in valuations between those two needs to close in the short term, and we're starting to see that. My expectations, it continues.
Sure. So it'll be quite interesting, obviously, to something to keep an eye on, kind of on the, you know, the next kind of, well, certainly the next year for sure, and going further down the line as well. And I wanted to now kind of just turn more specifically to the Far East region. Because it's fared, you know, rather better recently than other global equity markets. You know, looking at the FTSE All Share is down some 6% over the last 12 months. The MSCI Europe ex-UK is up about 7%. And the S&P 500 is up around 20%. Although notably, the MSCI AC Far East is up close to 30%. And China's benchmark CSI 300 index is up around 35%. What have been the key drivers of that outperformance?
Well, the bottom line is that the whole impact from COVID has been far less significant in Asia than it's been in the rest of the world. And to my mind, that's for a few reasons. I think the response, the government response and the almost draconian nature of the lockdowns in Asia has been far more effective than we've seen in Europe, US and UK and elsewhere for that matter. We've also got much younger populations in Asia. So, you know, the levels of death rates and mortality rates have been lower on the whole. So basically Asia's recovered from the COVID lockdown and the COVID impacts much quicker than elsewhere. So to the point where GDP growth in Asia in 2021 will be higher than it was in 2019. And when we look back on this historically, we'll see that actually the impact on the region as a whole has been fairly negligible. In the same context, earnings will be higher this year than they were in pre-COVID, and so will dividends. And when you compare that to the rest of the world, I think it's still a leap of faith, really, to say how long it's going to take for the economies in UK, Europe, and the US to recover their pre-COVID levels, and the same with corporate earnings and dividends. So I think it's all about the certainty of recovery, and Asia has a much more certain recovery outlook at this point than the rest of the world. And that's driven that relative performance.
No, absolutely. And I think that speed with which, you know, specifically certain Asian countries, you know, including China, South Korea and Taiwan, you know, that they responded to the coronavirus. And as you say, as they are recovering from it, you know, it has been well documented. Although that are some of the, you know, poorer nations, including India and Indonesia, are still struggling to contain it. How do you feel this north-south divide, if you like, has been shaping your thinking about asset allocation for the trust, you know, in the year that we've had, but also going forward into 2021 and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly favoured North Asia over South Asia through most of this year. And I think in the short term, that trend continues. I mean, the problem with India and Indonesia, and the points I made earlier about the draconian lockdowns and the response times, etc., which have generally helped Asia recover from COVID quicker than most, don't really apply to some of these countries you mentioned, India and Indonesia being a prime example. And I think there's a fairly good reason for that. They obviously benefit from the same younger population, warmer temperatures, etc., which help in the restriction of the spread of COVID. But there's much less nationalistic fervor in those countries than there is, say, in China, in Taiwan, etc. Basically, it's much more difficult for a central government to impart restrictions on a country which, rather than Indian, they consider to be Punjabi. In Indonesia, they consider themselves to be Javanese rather than Indonesian, etc. So it's much more difficult for central government to apply the same levels of restrictions in those markets as we've seen in some of the more Chinese-based economies. Even so, I think there will come a point later this year when South Asian countries will start to look a little better. COVID will hopefully come under wraps, and these economies will start opening again. And the valuation differentials, again, as we go back to value, at this point in time is favouring South Asia over North Asia. But in the short term, as the world expands, North Asia is the area where you have exposure to manufacturing of goods which have benefited from COVID, work from home, computers, semiconductors, new energy technology, etc. And I suspect that continues for a while. But as we look through the second half of the year, I wouldn't be surprised to see our attention moving further south from where it is currently.
I was also keen to kind of follow on that question as well, actually, you know, looking at the region from a sector perspective. And I think you touched on a couple of sectors just there, and in kind of in the context of finding value as well. And so I was just wondering if you could maybe elaborate a bit more on any sectors that are striking you as representing sort of particularly good value at the moment. And if so, why? You know, is it because of the impact of the coronavirus, or, you know, other reasons?
Yeah, I mean, this is the bit that's quite difficult for us as an income investor. You know, the real value sits in companies which are benefiting from reopening, i.e. normalization. But in a lot of cases, because they've been impacted quite significantly by COVID, there's little or no income in those sectors. So if we talk about, you know, travel, tourism, consumer discretionary, retail malls, these kind of areas which traditionally have been quite happy hunting grounds for the income investor, this time around a little bit tougher, because we don't expect income to return anytime soon, and rightly so, because their businesses have been so impacted. I mean, what we try and find is a combination of value, growth, and income. And it's really difficult to find any sector at this point in time which incorporates all three of those areas, because the value companies, as I say, maybe have not reinstated their dividends fully yet. So the yields aren't the levels we want, although there's growth there. The growth companies don't have value because people are pricing growth so highly. So it's a difficult time. Well, there's opportunities out there, but to get all three of those points in the stocks we own is not so easy. The sector that really at the moment ticks our boxes is the materials sector. So iron ore, copper, aluminium, nickel, these kind of areas, which we think there's very strong demand out there, and they play into the structural themes of electric vehicles and electrification and new energy and these kind of things. But obviously don't have the massive premiums of some of the companies in this area. And of course, they're generating so much cash flow because prices have gone up so much that we're seeing very high dividends. So that's the sector which we have quite decent exposure to and have been adding to in recent months.
And would you say, has materials, is that tend to be a sector that's a bit more cyclical?
It does. But there's some strange things going on in materials at the moment. Firstly, because prices historically have been quite low, so there's been no investment in this area. You know, some of the ESG constraints have also meant that some of the big players have kind of pulled away from investing in these areas. You know, oil, it would also be in that category as well. So every time you listen to Shell and BP, they talk about wind and solar and everything like that, and not about replenishing the reserves in oil. So we've got a bit of a supply shortage in a lot of these key materials through lack of investment. And now we have some incentives, if you like, some structural growth drivers. So, for example, there's more copper needed in an electric car than there is in a standard car. Wind and solar actually require more copper than traditional thermal power. So there's some demand drivers, which are structural rather than cyclical, plus the fact that there is a lack of investment in this area. So supply is somewhat constrained, which is why we've seen these prices go up quite considerably.
And that's fascinating, actually, I think, to kind of sort of see that, I suppose, that shift, really, you know, or even in that sector. You know, from your perspective, you know, have you seen, you know, other shifts, you know, not necessarily of exactly the same kind of nature, but, you know, other things happening in elsewhere that have meant you've kind of adapted your approach, you know, whether that's the case to maybe allocating or maybe reducing on the basis that you kind of think maybe from a valuation perspective that the tide will be turning? Or is it really quite difficult, as you say, at the moment to kind of be doing that on a bit of a broader sector basis? And it really is from a bottom up viewpoint.
I think in general, you know, we would love to own some of these structural things. It's just the valuations are just prohibitive. Tesla is kind of the poster child of everything that's difficult for a value and income investor. You know, when a stock has a $700 billion market cap and has a bigger market cap than the rest of the auto industry put together, yet only makes 1% of the world's cars. You know, that to me is a level of extreme, which is very difficult to invest in, and other companies are being priced off that. So valuations are extreme in some of these areas, and the same, you know, for the things like around ESG and new energy, etc. Again, prohibitive levels of valuations. So we prefer the enablers rather than the frontline companies, which is why we like the materials sector, which enables electric vehicles and new energy. We also like the electronics manufacturing rather than necessarily investing in the internet e-commerce names, which again we find too expensive. So whether that's through memory or foundry or other semiconductor services, that to us is much more interesting. So we've been focusing on those in general. On the other side of the portfolio, which maybe tends to get a little bit ignored because we'll talk about these structural things and growth, is we shouldn't forget about the fact that, you know, interest rates are at record lows and we have populations aging across the world. So the need for yield has kind of got lost in all this noise. But the bottom line is that, you know, we have a yield, as you said, on 7% on Henderson Far East. And a lot of the companies we own in the portfolio have similar levels of yield. And I think these companies will attract attention as that demand for yield increases once maybe we've got over this, what's the best way to describe it? Short-term euphoria. Let's go with that.
I actually also wanted to pick up on that point, actually, about the trust yield there as well. And, you know, it's undoubtedly an attractive, you know, 7% figure for an incoming investor. I'm just curious, you know, if you were evaluating it in the same manner as you do for individual stocks for the portfolio, you know, you may perhaps have reservations over that kind of figure. You know, does it feel too high, you know, given the quality of the assets you own? And does it raise a question mark over the portfolio and whether, you know, it's sustainable?
I think it's undoubtedly yield is cheap. And I think that's reflected, as you say, in the level of yield we have for Henderson Far East Income. And I think there is a connection between the level of yield we have and the valuation of the companies we have in the portfolio. I think going forward, as I said before, when the highest yielding stocks in the index trade at the biggest discount to the broad market that we've seen in 20 years, there is a reason for yield to produce decent capital returns from here. We certainly saw that after the GFC, when we had the sell-off and then the bounce back, yield was at a discount. And then we entered a period of benign economic growth supported by low interest rates. And that's not too dissimilar, I think, to where we are now. Yet dividend yield trades at such a big discount. To my mind, that discount narrows. So yes, I think, you know, yield for us is from here, is a capital uplift proposition as well as just an attractive income story.
My last question for you today, Mike, is actually around the New York Stock Exchange's recent decision to delist three state-owned Chinese telecom companies. And, you know, this seems to set to inflame tensions further between the US and China, albeit Biden presidency may go some way towards softening the US stance. Keen to get your thoughts and your views on how you see the situation unfolding between the two in the context of the Asian equity markets.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a story that's gone a little bit quiet with everything else that's been going on. And I think that's a good thing. So clearly we've got away from the Trump tweet scenario, where there'd be comments which were either backed up or not backed up with some kind of policy. And I think we've reverted to something which is a lot more predictable rather than what we had previously. But don't get me wrong here. I don't think this means that the stance is softening on China in any way, shape or form. I think it's just that the route we use and the route we go down will be much more traditional. I think Biden and the Biden presidency, rather than going on a unilateral basis, we'll go on a multilateral basis and try and rope in Europe and other countries around the world to put pressure on China. And there'll be things drawn out through negotiation and process and protocol, which we didn't see under the previous administration. What does this mean for the relationship between the US and China? I think it remains fraught for a number of years. I think there's an inevitability about the fact that China will usurp the US as the largest economy in the world in the next 10 years, and how the US reacts to that and how China tries to impress itself and its role in the world will bring the two countries head to head at some point. And I just hope it's conducted in a civil and friendly way rather than through other means. In terms specifically about the US sanctions on Chinese corporates, that's not going to be reversed, I don't think, in the same way that it's unlikely to reverse anytime soon the restrictions on Huawei and the technology sector. So yes, it's quieter. Yes, I think it's more transparent. But is it going to lead to a better relationship between the US and China? I'm not so sure.
So, you know, relations there, you know, perhaps not at the forefront as they once were, perhaps with the news agenda a couple of years ago, but still certainly prominent and rumbling on by the sounds of it. So, Mike, I just want to say thank you very much for your time today. It was great speaking with you, and I hope to catch up again soon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, and share this with anyone you think will also find it interesting. If you want to learn more about investment trusts, we have a wealth of information available on our website, which you can find in the show notes. Glossary. Asset allocation. The allocation of a portfolio according to an asset class, sector, geographical region, or type of security. Benchmark. A standard against which a portfolio's performance can be measured. For example, the performance of a UK equity fund may be benchmarked against a market index such as the FTSE 100, which represents the 100 largest companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. A benchmark is often called an index. Capital appreciation, an increase in the price or value of assets. Catalyst value, a revelation or event that propels the price of a security dramatically up or down. Cyclical stocks. Companies that sell discretionary consumer items, such as cars, or industries highly sensitive to changes in the economy, such as miners. The prices of equities and bonds issued by cyclical companies tend to be strongly affected by ups and downs in the overall economy when compared to non-cyclical companies. Discount. When the market price of a security is thought to be less than its underlying value, it is said to be trading at a discount. Within investment trusts, this is the amount by which the price per share of an investment trust is lower than the value of its underlying net asset value, the opposite of trading at a premium. Dividend, a payment made by a company to its shareholders. The amount is variable and is paid as a portion of the company's profits. Economic cycle, the fluctuation of the economy between expansion, growth, and contraction, recession. It's influenced by many factors, including household, government and business spending, trade, technology and central bank policy. ESG, environmental, social and governance, are three key criteria used to evaluate a company's ethical impact and sustainable practices. Growth investing. Growth investors search for companies they believe have strong growth potential. Their earnings are expected to grow at an above average rate compared to the rest of the market, and therefore there is an expectation that their share prices will increase in value. Inflation, the rate at which the prices of goods and services are rising in an economy. The CPI and RPI are two common measures. This is the opposite of deflation. Portfolio, a grouping of financial assets such as equities, bonds, and cash, also often called a fund. A price-to-earnings ratio, or PE ratio, a popular ratio used to value a company's shares. It is calculated by dividing the current share price by its earnings per share. In general, a high PE ratio indicates that investors expect strong earnings growth in the future, although a temporary collapse in earnings can also lead to a high PE ratio. Value investing. Value investors search for companies that they believe are undervalued by the market and therefore expect their share price to increase. One of the favored techniques is to buy companies with low price-to-earnings ratios. See also growth investing. Yield. The level of income on a security, typically expressed as a percentage rate. For equities, a common measure is the dividend yield, which divides recent dividend payments for each share by the share price. For a bond, this is calculated as the coupon payment divided by the current bond price. Quantitative easing, QE. An unconventional monetary policy used by central banks to stimulate the economy by boosting the amount of overall money in the banking system. For a full list of terms, please see our glossary. For promotional purposes, not for onward distribution. Before investing in an investment trust referred to in this podcast, you should satisfy yourself as to its suitability and the risks involved. You may wish to consult a financial advisor. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The value of an investment and the income from it can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested. Nothing in this podcast is intended or should be construed as advice. This podcast is not a recommendation to sell or purchase any investment. It does not form part of any contract for the sale or purchase of any investment. References made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security. Janus Henderson Investors, one of its affiliate advisors, or its employees may have a position mentioned in the securities mentioned in this podcast. Issued in the UK by Janus Henderson Investors. Janus Henderson Investors is the name under which investment products and services are provided by Janus Capital International Limited. Registration number 359-4615. Henderson Global Investors Limited. Registration number 906355. Henderson Investment Funds Limited. Registration number 267-8531. Henderson Equity Partners Limited. Registration number 260-6646. Each registered in England and Wales at 201 Bishopsgate, London, EC2M 3AE, and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. And Henderson Management SA, registration number B22848, at 2 Rue de Bitburg, L-1273, Luxembourg, and regulated by the Commission de Surveillance du Secteur Financier. Janus Henderson, Janus Henderson, Perkins, Intech, Velocity Shares, Knowledge Shared, Knowledge Shared, and Knowledge Labs are trademarks of Janus Henderson Group PLC or one of its subsidiaries. Copyright Janus Henderson Group PLC.